I got a call in the post office from my agent in London going, they want to see you for a Bond film.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, am I going to be a Bond girl? And she was like, no, you don't fuck anyone and you don't kill anyone, so you're not a Bond girl.
You just sing a country and western song.
I was like, great, I'm in. And then you were in GoldenEye too.
That's right. Actually, my God, look what I've got next to me here.
What have you got?
A GoldenEye pinball machine. You're on it. You're on it. Wait, I'll take it.
Wait, you bastard. I've seen one of these. I'm on the fucking pinball machine.
Wait a minute. Where are you? Oh, there you are.
Oh, my God. I made it on the pinball machine.
Oh, I'm underneath you.
Okay, Alan, I can't even believe it. I can't believe that you have the pinball machine.
And also, you know, the other thing about that film is that it's a video game. I didn't know about that until years later. And I had an assistant called Landon at the time. I said, Landon, I'm in a video game. He was like, yeah, I know. If you piss me off, I go home and shoot you in the balls.
Hello, I'm Minnie Driver. And welcome to Minnie Questions. I've always loved Proust's Questionnaire. It was originally an 18th century parlor game meant to reveal an individual's true nature. But with so many questions, there wasn't really an opportunity to expand on anything. So I took the format of Proust's Questionnaire and adapted what I think are 7 of the most important questions you could ever ask someone. They are, when and where were you happiest? What is the quality you like least about yourself? What relationship, real or fictionalized, defines love for you? What question would you most like answered? What person, place, or experience has shaped you the most? What would be your last meal? And can you tell me something in your life that has grown out of a personal disaster? The more people we ask, the more we begin to see what makes us similar and what makes us individual. I've gathered a group of really remarkable people who I'm honored and humbled to have had a chance to engage with. My guest today is Alan Cumming. He is an actor in movies like X-Men and in the TV show The Good Wife. He is an author, he has an OBE, and he is a podcaster. He's also an articulate, powerful voice in and for the LGBTQ community, and he's been my friend for 30 years. We made this short film together called That Sunday in the early 90s. It's worth having a dig and finding it if you can, along with the film Circle of Friends and then GoldenEye. I had a hard time not constantly interrupting and finishing his sentences in this interview, largely because my brain likes to go down the same pathways as Alan's, which is to say, off the main road and deep into glorious woodland. He is a deep and generous soul and has a way of sharing the painful parts of his past with great compassion and great humour.
What relationship, real or fictionalized, defines love for you?
Well,
is it you and me in Circle of Friends? Is it?
What did I call you again?
What is it you call me? I can remember. Hold on, I can see it.
I remember I said something about the succulent bird, but that wasn't about you. I was just talking about the chicken that we're eating as I was alluding. But at the end, I said something awful to you.
You called me a something bitch and I can't remember what it is. God.
Yeah, yeah. But back to love. Unconditional love, I think, with Grant Schaefer, my husband upstairs. Not that I've got another one downstairs, but you know what I mean?
I was going to say, you show me the one in the basement.
I feel I've reached a point with him after so long where it's, you know, he pisses me off. But I just feel this completely solid, true thing that I just can't imagine we can get over anything.
Does that define love for you, that notion of solid?
Unconditional love. Unconditional love, does, I think. Yeah, because no matter what happens, I'm going to have this love.
Right. No matter the circumstances, the vagaries of the circumstance in life.
Exactly. But then actually what I would say is more unconditional love is my relationship with dogs. So I've got Lala and Jerry upstairs and I'm very attached to Lala. I'm attached to them both, but you know, I think I'm more of a special relationship with Lala. And I had my dog Honey before that. There's a sort of a statue of her over there on a little deck, who was my longest adult relationship. I mean, like Grant has now superseded her, but she was the longest relationship I had through thick and thin, through terrible things in my life. That was a true unconditional love. And I talk about her all the time, actually. She's sort of very present in our lives. And then she's in the portrait of me at the Scottish National Portrait Gallery. She's referenced.
Oh, the one that replaced the Queen.
Yes, it replaced the Queen.
I love that your portrait replaced the Queen.
They brought the Queen down. Like, the Queen was in blanket over her and taken in some back.
They put the Queen down and they put another Queen up.
Insert your Queen jokes here. They moved me around. The last time, I think I was in between Tilda Swinton and Annie Lennox. So that's a nice sandwich.
Oh my God, that's the best sandwich ever. But wait, but Honey's in that portrait?
Well, she's, yes, because she died just before I got painted and the guy was asking me about things. So there's a little jar beside me and it says Honey on it in the picture.
Oh my God, is it her ashes?
No, it's just a jar. I just put her into the picture.
Oh, I thought you meant...
No, her ashes are upstairs.
I was going to say, was it her ashes that just said honey? No, actually, it was a jar of honey.
Yeah, just a jar of honey. But it says honey on it. And then it says yes, 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 because I was really sad about the Scottish independence thing had gone the wrong way.
Yeah.
What was hilarious was I'm wearing this kilt around my neck in the portrait. And it was unveiled at the Scottish National Portrait Gallery in the big, you know, main place that took the Queen down, you know. And it was all posh and everyone was having drinks and there's a film crew because they're filming it for that Sky Portrait Artist of the Year thing. And I say a few words. I said, oh, it's so exciting because this tartan, the kilt I'm wearing, it's the official tartan of the Yes Campaign for Independence. And it was all these clinking of glasses of the old unionists in the room. And it was such a great thing for me, like, to know that in that painting, which will be there forever, it's not only his little honey reference, but this subversive little message that I managed to get in. But yes, when I realised that she was going to die before me, I remember just thinking, oh, you know, Honey's in my life. She's my sort of girlfriend. And I just remember when someone sort of said something in reference about her dying. And I thought, oh my God, she's a dog. Yeah, dogs die before you. She's going to die. And it was such a weird thing because I so thought of her as like a human relationship, how much sort of time I took to think about her and the way she featured in my life and the decisions I had to make because of her. It was very much like having an actual person.
I totally understand that.
You've got, what's his name down on licking your feet?
Okay, well, Bob's a difficult soul and I've closed his ears. He's not listening. He's a bit deaf anyway. The true great love of my life was my Labrador, Bubba, who I had for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
Who died in my arms. And he was the greatest precursor to having a child, particularly having a son. And there's a lot of similarities. Like, if anyone wants to have a road test, having a baby boy, get a Labrador.
Right.
They just want to be loved.
Rambunctious.
They want to eat. They jump around a lot and need exercise. And you need to go to sleep when they do. And that's it.
Right.
It's the same protocol.
I always think people should have a dog first when they're thinking about kids.
Totally.
Remember Rachel Weisz, we were chatting, she said to Grant, do you have children? And he went, well, we have two dogs and blah, blah. And they had a conversation about dogs for a bit. And then he said to her, what about you? And Rachel went, well, I have a human child. I thought, bless you for entertaining these two old queers who are just talking about their dogs. And you have to remind us that your child is a human.
It was very, very respectful to qualify that it was a human child so as to not denigrate your fur babies.
Yeah. Oh, I hate fur babies, though. I hate that word.
I hate it. It's like, it's hashtag blessed. Lives in the same space. It's vile.
And also, like, when Honey died and people said, oh, they'll meet them at the
Rainbow Bridge.
I was like, no, they fucking won't.
Yeah, no. I want to dynamite that shit.
I hate that Rainbow Bridge.
Me too.
Oh.
It's no Rainbow Bridge. I do sometimes see Bubba when I'm in a Soul Cycle class, though. Like, he's running beside me on my stationary bike. It's really weird.
Wow. When you're in a sort of a fever of sweat and Soul Cycle, it sort of feels like slightly cultish.
It's totally cultish. It's amazing.
And I can imagine you getting into a reverie.
It's like being in a really sweaty cult.
Yeah.
With like a motivational speaker at the helm of this ship.
Yeah.
And I think you do go into a bit of a trance and then you start seeing your dead dog. This is my favourite question.
Yes.
What would be your last meal?
I would have stovies. Stovies is an old Scottish thing. I guess it's because it's on the stove. It's like supposed to be for when you're drinking, you leave it there and you go and you have a little some stovies. It's potatoes and onions. Meat, I do a vegan version. It's delicious. It's just like the most carby, starchy thing. So delicious. I put garlic and other things in it and soy sauce and blah, blah, blah. See, I really think I'm a peasant. It's so interesting. I discovered recently I'm part Portuguese. I did that thing you send off. I'm 6% Portuguese.
Aye, that's quite a lot.
Isn't it? I had no idea. I'm a little bit sort of German. There was a few percentages there, but, you know, I'm mostly Scottish and north of England.
I'm literally an Anglo-Saxon. Like, I basically was either one of the people that the Vikings came and found who already lived here. A bit of picked. I have nothing exotic in me at all, unless I'm, you know, drinking tequila. That's the most exotic I get, something interesting in me.
How funny. I love that. I was a little more saucy than I thought, but mostly, you know, white Scottish boy. But the thing was, I'm very much a peasant. I really feel very peasanty. And I know that I am from sort of peasant stock on my father's side of the family.
Me too.
Are you?
Utter, complete, 100% peasants, some of who could play musical instruments. And so we're musical peasants.
Musical peasants, I love that. That's a good band name.
Wait, go on. So you're a peasant. So what does that mean, you like eating?
So my dad's family all worked and lived on Cawdor Estate for generations, like on the farms or in the forestry. My dad was a forester. And then what was hilarious is that if you go to Cawdor Castle, you look up on the wall, there's a portrait of me.
No.
Seriously, it looks like me in a period film. It's insane. And when it was open to the public in about the 90s, something, whatever, people sent me this postcard. This thing. I said, what the hell? And then I thought, wait a minute. Maybe there was some dabbling below stairs. Because, I mean,
no,
I,
of course there
I
was.
Look so much like that man who was like the first Earl of Cawdor or something.
So actually, you think that you are an aristocrat?
I'm of peasant stock, but there was dabbling below stairs. And if I could just get one of the, like, Cawdor family's
DNA
chunk of their hair,
yeah,
and do it, I would be able to prove. But I don't think I want to do that.
Yeah, we need to go to a few more parties and, like, steal some whiskey glasses.
Wouldn't that be hilarious?
I'm sorry, Duchess.
It was always that thing about, remember, they were trying to get Prince Harry's DNA. People were trying to steal bits of Prince Harry's hair. I felt
constantly. It was happening in a nightclub. I think my brother was working the door and somebody was trying to sort of snip Harry's hair.
Can you imagine?
God, poor love. No wonder he's gone to California. I mean, seriously, I man. Quick, get back to the food.
Yeah, so the food, because of my peasant thing, I love food that is one bowl of the same thing. Like, you know, if you have too many different options, if you've got, like, you know, lots of vegetables, and it's too overwhelming for me. I don't like it. I like to mush them all together. And I like to eat things with a spoon. It's that I love more than anything, the feeling of having the same taste again and again and eating it with a spoon. That's what I would do. I suppose it's very like baby food. It's probably going back to the, it's like the seven ages of man. But that's what my last meal would be. Stovies.
It's very safe and it feels very primal, that, and it, also yes, understandable. Something, yeah, that is in one bowl.
It's comforting.
It's comforting. Do you know what? I mean, I get confused in posh restaurants sometimes. I mean, I've been undone by like a foam on top of something.
God.
God save me from foam. It looks like fish spit. I can't do it. I agree with you. I like a bowl. And those have become fashionable now. You know, they're on the menu, like a bowl. Would you like the ancient grain bowl?
Yes, that's right. There's the Buddha bowls and things.
Do those make you happy?
Yeah, I like those. And like, I think I'm more in the Asian thing as well. Like, you know, I made a film in Australia and they had congee for breakfast, which is like porridge and then you put all these things in it. I love, that's my dream.
Oh God, that is delicious. I like poke bowls in Hawaii.
A poke bowl, yes.
I lived there for a while and I ate a lot of...
What did you? Why were you in Hawaii?
Oh, I left Hollywood. I hated it and nobody noticed I'd left because I had two films come out the year that I went and lived in Hawaii. It was quite funny. I went there just to write music and to surf and to live on the beach and hang out.
Gosh. I made a film there, that Tempest film that Julia Taymor directed.
Oh my God, that's right.
Helen
you did
Mirren
that.
was Prospera. And it was just so hilarious, like being in the hot tub with like Chris Cooper and David Strathairn and Tom Conti and Russell Brand and, you know, practicing our lines for the next day in the hot tub of the Four Seasons in that funny little island camera. It was quite a long time. I went back and forward a bit. Such a hoot though.
Love. Okay, what question would you most like answered?
Ugh, I mean, I think it would have to be what was wrong with my father. What was the true mental diagnosis of him? You know, I think maybe 10 years ago I'd have said, why did my father not love me? And I've got over that one. You know, as I found out all this evidence about him, you know, I came to the conclusion, not just like, oh, he's insane and awful, but he just was mentally ill. And I would love to get proper diagnosis. And I never will because obviously I can't examine him or have anyone examine him. But that to me is something I would really love to have answered, just what it actually was that made him behave the way he did.
Do you think that if a person can give something a name, it can be understood better? Does it stay nebulous and therefore threatening if you can't contain it with the word?
I think it's just a thing of it takes it outside of your experience. It makes it something that exists in the world that wasn't just about you, do you know? So perhaps that is what you're saying. And I've talked to psychiatrists about this. You know, I have actually spent quite a lot of time trying to diagnose my father from beyond the grave personality disorders that he clearly had. But there's more. And I don't know quite why and when, you know, and what kicked it in. And because something that was such a big part of my life that is kind of a mystery. And I've definitely made peace with that. And I understand truly that he was mentally ill. And I've just made it easier to come to terms with and to forgive and to sort of, not so much to forgive, that was easy, but to sort of place what happened to me in a context that I can get myself out of it. But obviously, I'm never going to have a proper answer. So that would be the thing I would like the answer to, yeah.
I'm sorry you won't have the answer to that question. I hope that the exploration or the interrogation of what it might be, I hope that there were enough people that said the same thing that have given you a good idea of what it might have been.
Definitely. There's, you know, narcissistic disorders, psychotic personalities. There's all these things. But, you know, you can't really do that just on one person's memory. You have to get in a bit deeper. So it's so interesting to me. I'm really fascinated by the various sort of little psychological quirks we all have.
I agree.
And I think that's maybe because, you know, from such an early age, I was so aware of it. I was so aware of them. I was aware that my dad was not right.
Right.
And not right as in wrong, as well as being not right psychologically. I had a very good sort of balance between my mum and my dad. So I knew they both couldn't be right. And also, I hate to say it, but I think that's also why I'm quite a good actor, is that I can understand, get into sort of people's psychological quirks because I'm aware of the difference. I see it quite a lot. So I was used to looking for it.
What person, place, or experience most altered your life?
Again, I'm going to say my father. I know I keep sort of bringing it back there, but...
No, it's good because you wrote a book about your experiences with your father, and someone very early on said to me, when I'd not drawing a comparison between an abusive childhood and a heartbreak, but I was suffering terribly from a heartbreak and I wrote a record, and a musician that I love said, oh yeah, you know, wherever possible, you should profit off your pain.
Yes.
Whatever that well is of your father, that he would be the question that you would want answered, that it's the person who altered or affected your life so much. They are connected, those questions for you. So
yeah, exactly. And also it's sort of, you know, in positive ways as well. I mean, like, what's really been fascinating is right after we made Circle of Friends, actually, I had this nervous breakdown.
I remember.
It was basically because I realised, oh, I'm this person, I'm Alan, happy Alan. Not terribly different from how I am now, I mean, on the surface. But I was a construct of something my father had done that I'd not remembered. So I thought, I've become this person by ignoring, you know, suppressing this whole side of these things that happened to me. I don't want to be this person anymore. I want to embrace this terrible thing that's happened to me to become the person I'm supposed to be. So that was a huge thing that he influenced me. That completely changed my life. And then when he told me I wasn't his son, that was pretty huge. And then the ability to go back and talk to him and tell him I was indeed his son after I got the DNA test and everything. You know, things like that are monumental moments that really change you in terms of, like, I stood up to the scariest possible monster I could stand up to. I'm now fearless. And then writing about it and realizing that actually how important it is and how many people's lives I changed by telling my story and helped them to be able to deal with things in their life. I had no idea that would happen. That was such a shocker to me. And then also to realize that I have brought my father back into my life in a way that he never was before. So I didn't push him away like I thought. I actually brought him in. But as you say, it's on my terms. So it's been a series of things like that has really, truly, primarily changed me. And all of them actually are positive things. I mean, the actual stuff before, you know, the childhood was awful. But actually, as an adult, the huge sort of cataclysmic things that happened were ultimately very, very positive things for me, because it was about me coming my true authentic self and not a construct of something that he had made me.
Oh, Danny is so articulate.
Oh, bless you.
I mean, I'm so sorry those things happened to you, but it sort of feeds into the last question that I have. It's very revealing. In your life, can you tell me about something that has grown out of a personal disaster?
Well, yes, me. Just my entire body.
Me. Yeah.
I grew out of a personal disaster. Yeah, I mean, I think I would say several relationships that have broken up, like a marriage, a couple of marriages, you know, sort of thing, that were, when I was in them, definitely be described as personal disasters when they were breaking up, and just the sort of ugliness of all that. But actually, you know, getting older and looking back on things and seeing the patterns, you notice the patterns of behavior of yours as well as other people's, that gives you an opportunity to make a decision about, are you going to behave differently now in this, when this happens, or, you know, are you going to make the same mistake, or maybe this is a good pattern to repeat? That to me is really fascinating. But there's definitely a couple of relationships that I've had that ended with a personal disaster and beautiful things came out of it. Like I think about, talking of circle friends and everything, like Saffron and I's relationship is such a beautiful, strong, loving friendship. I really feel that I, you know, and she knows this too, that we would be there for each other till we die. You know, we were together as a couple for a couple of years, and that didn't work out. It worked out for a while, but then it didn't. And actually, something so much better has come out of it. So there's a couple of people in my life that I feel like that about. It's kind of funny that quite a lot of my very close friends have been my lovers.
Really?
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah, too many, actually, I suppose, when you think about it. But I mean, not in the same way, like with Saf, that was like we were in a proper relationship together. But, you know, there's several of my friends, more in the gay world, several of my male friends, I've had sex with them at some point in the past, you know, first, and then we stayed friends. And I think that's really good. I think it's really good.
I think it's lovely. I think it's lovely. I think it's quite unusual. I can count on one hand the people that have been lovers that are friends. Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky.
I think it is easier in a same-sex relationship. Actually.
Do you? Why?
Yeah. Because I think sex is easier in general, actually, in a same-sex relationship.
Do you?
Yes, because you understand the person.
What, like ergonomically or spiritually?
Spiritually. I mean, yeah, well, sort of both. Because you are the same gender as that person, you automatically understand more things about how that person works.
Thinks and feels. Yeah.
Thinks and feels. And also, I think, therefore, you can be more honest with that person. There's not such a barrier of a gender. And also, you know, men and women are fed so much shit that makes it more difficult for them to communicate.
That is so true.
You know,
that
it's just so true. Ridiculous.
It's like we are raised on a completely and utterly different social, psychic and mental food. Yeah. Yeah.
And impossible to keep up standards. And so anyway, I think it's easier to be honest with the person of your own sex. And it's easier to move on from sex with a person of your own sex as well. I do. I mean, look at lesbians. It's like a joke, but when you see a group of friends who are lesbians, they've all slept with each other at some point, yeah. And they're all great friends, and they're all godmothers to their children. I think that's a case in point, that you can move on from and still keep a loving thing. Whereas with men and women, it's over, and that's it. Many years later, you can come back as a sort of thing. But I don't think there's the same sort of elision into great friendship that can happen in a same-sex relationship. Sadly.
Oh, God, I could talk to you for, like, 99 hours. I'm going to have to come. As soon as we're all allowed, I'm going to come and find you in your remote location.
I'd love you to come here.
Oh, my God, I will. I'll come and play some music. If you've got a piano, I'll bring my guitar.
Yeah. Oh, we've got it all. Got it all.
We've got it all, mate. We've got it all.
This has been fun. Thanks, Minnie. I've really enjoyed this.
I'm really fascinated and so grateful you've just shared your heart and your life so generously. Thank you, darling.
My pleasure.
Very much.
All right. Lots of love to you.
In closing, I would like to make you aware of some projects that Alan has coming up. I think my particular favourite is a 6-part podcast series for Audible about a sperm bank heist that he produced and directed called Hot White Heist, starring Saturday Night Live's Bowen Yang, along with an ensemble of amazing people, including Cynthia Nixon, Abby Jacobson, Jane Lynch, and Margaret Cho.
He also has a show for Apple TV coming in July called Schmigadoon, and another show for HBO Max also coming in July called The Prince. He is the busiest man in show business, quite rightly. Mini Questions is hosted and written by me, Minnie Driver. Supervising producer, Aaron Kaufman. Producer, Morgan Lavoie. Research assistant, Marissa Brown. Original music, Sorry Baby, by Minnie Driver. Additional music by Aaron Kaufman. Executive produced by me and Mangesh Hettigadur. Special thanks to Jim Nicolay, Will Pearson, Addison O'Day, Lisa Castella and Anique Oppenheim at WKPR, De La Pescador, Kate Driver and Jason Weinberg, and for constantly solicited tech support, Henry Driver.